In 1910, a young Hungarian scientist named George de Hevesy arrived in England to study radioactivity. A few months in, he started getting homesick, and actually, the food at his boarding house in Manchester was really making him sick. Hevesy suspected that the cafeteria was recycling leftovers, so being the clever scientist he was, he did an experiment.
He took too much meat at dinner one night and, when the landlady's back was turned, sprinkled hot lead over it. She gathered his leftovers as normal, and the next day Hevesy brought home a newfangled radiation detector from his lab buddy, Hans Geiger. Sure enough, when he waved it over that night's goulash, Geiger's counter went furious. Click, 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 click.
Now, lead is a main group element on the periodic table, and this story is one of hundreds told in a new book about the periodic table. It's called The Disappearing Spoon, and the voice you just heard is its author, Sam Keen, who joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Hi. Nice to be here.
No one needs a description of the periodic table, right? It's a sort of as iconic as an Eames chair or the Chrysler building. Everybody can picture what it looks like. The scourge of high school students the world over. Maybe not for you. And yet you say you can actually write history through the prism of that table.
Yes. One thing I really wanted to get across in the book is that there are so many different facets of history you can find in the periodic table. You can look at war on the periodic table. You can look at literature and art. Obviously, you can get into science history, but then you get into a lot of the personalities of the people behind it. Some very great scientists, and there's a few rogues running around on the periodic table, too.
Yeah, Sam Keen, the title of your book, The Disappearing Spoon, is actually about a spoon that did disappear in a cup of tea. How did that happen?
It's sort of a classic prank for scientists. The element we're talking about is gallium, which appears right below aluminum on the periodic table. Gallium has a sort of an unusual property. It melts at about 80 degrees, which means that when you have it at room temperature, it's solid. It looks just like something that's made out of aluminum. When it gets a little hotter than 80 degrees, though, it starts to melt. So even if you held a little plug of it in your hand, it would start to melt. The prank is that scientists sometimes like to serve it with tea. And a guest has no idea it's anything but aluminum. When you pick it up and put it in your tea, though, and pull it out, it looks like the tea has eaten the end of your utensil.
You write about a man named Kenneth Parker, better known as the head of Parker Pens. He made a fortune by consulting the periodic table. How did he do it?
Parker had an idea for a pen he called the Parker 51, and it was going to be the greatest pen anyone had ever seen. The problem with it and the first designs of it was that the nib, the part of the pen that actually touches the paper, was too soft, and it would deform when people were writing it, which is obviously a big problem with pens. He first tried to make it out of an alloy called osmium-iridium. Unfortunately, osmium and iridium, the two elements involved, are rare, and it was a headache to import. So he went to a different element called ruthenium, and ruthenium proved to be perfect. It was very durable, very hard, and it was pretty abundant. Not many people wanted to mine it either, so it was pretty cheap. When that element, ruthenium, was added to the nib, it made it very hard, and after that, the sales of the Parker pens really took off. It became the best-selling pen in history, actually, and the generals that signed the treaties to end World War II actually were using Parker 51 pens.
I'm speaking with Sam Keen. He's the author of the new book, The Disappearing Spoon, Tales from the Periodic Table. Sam Keen, there's a politician in Montana that you write about. His name is Stan Jones. He's a libertarian. He won 3% of the vote, actually, the last time he ran for U.S. Senate. And you write how the periodic table practically derailed his career in 2002. What happened?
Well, Stan was a big believer that the Y2K virus was going to wipe out civilization. He was especially concerned that people wouldn't be able to find antibiotics. So he decided he was going to get his immune system ready for the apocalypse in 2000. And he turned to a metal, silver, that actually does have some antibacterial effects. And there are stories of, for instance, pioneers going across the United States with silver coins in their milk jugs because it prevented the milk from being spoiled. Unfortunately, Stan decided to take some pretty heavy doses of silver in water.
Just drink it.
Just drink the silver water. That has one unfortunate side effect. It makes your skin turn blue. So Stan ended up with blue skin while he was running for the Senate.
And is he still blue?
He's still blue. It's a permanent effect. You can't get that out of your skin.
But it doesn't kill you.
It doesn't kill you. He's perfectly healthy. And I think he actually told a magazine once that if he had to go back, he would do it again. It's more important to be healthy than to be blue.
All right, Godzilla. I got to ask you about Godzilla.
Mm-hmm.
Because Godzilla was only killed when missiles were fired at him, missiles that were tipped with cadmium. I guess cadmium is like the deadliest element?
It's not the deadliest. Traditionally, people say that thallium is the deadliest element. But cadmium is a very nasty element by itself.
Well, why they use cadmium?
Because in the 1930s and 40s, while the Japanese military was ramping up, there was a mine in central Japan that was mining zinc, which is related to cadmium on the periodic table. And they were dumping the leftover cadmium in the water. The farmers that were downstream were absorbing cadmium through the rice that they ate because the rice sponged it right up from the soil. It caused an epidemic, a widespread disease they ended up calling Atai-Atai disease, which stands for ouch-ouch disease, because they didn't know what caused it, and that's what the victims would cry out. It left them with kidney failure, and some of them had very soft bones. One doctor supposedly broke a girl's wrist just taking her pulse. Mm. Down history, though, that became known as one of the big four pollution diseases in Japanese history. So when the producers of the Godzilla film in 1985 needed to kill Godzilla off, they capped their missiles with cadmium. It's sort of a notorious poison there.
Just as you were wrapping up writing this book, there was some news. A new element was discovered, right?
Mm-hmm. Element 117, which fills in a gap on the bottom of the periodic table. It's called un-un-septium. That's a Latin name for 117. And it took a lot of work to create that element. For the elements on the bottom, it can sometimes take a decade or more of work just to create them. And what scientists usually end up with is six or so atoms of the element, and that's all they get. So it takes a lot of effort even to confirm that they have these elements. Most of them disintegrate in milliseconds or sometimes even shorter periods. And there's also what some scientists think is a cap on the periodic table at about element 137, about element 137 or so. And after that, no one is really sure if we can make heavier elements or not.
That's Sam Keen. His new book is called The Disappearing Spoon. It tells the history of science through the prism of the periodic table. Sam Keen, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Just as the Civil War was coming to an end, a young Scottish journeyman from Glasgow arrived on a ship to New York. His name was Tommy Lipton, and when he came to America, he was like thousands of other recent arrivals, penniless and anonymous. And in New York,
Lipton found a busy street lined with cheap hotels, cheaper flophouses, and saloons catering to sailors and other transients. Poles hung with dozens of telegraph wires marched down the avenues and cross streets, casting shadows and cross-hatching the sky. The air smelled of rotting garbage, horse manure, and the acrid smoke from the tall chimneys of a big soap factory that occupied several buildings a block away.
That's Michael D'Antonio reading from his new biography of Tommy Lipton. The young Glaswegian would spend 5 years in America doing odd jobs and taking mental notes before returning to Scotland to found his tea empire, Lipton Teas. Michael D'Antonio's book is called A Full Cup, and he joins me from our studios in New York. Welcome.
Great to be with you.
Now, before we get to how Tommy Lipton would become Thomas J. Lipton, one of the most famous tea merchants in history, let's start with that trip to America. It's 1864. He's 17 years old, and he comes to America. What was he looking to do? What was he looking to find out?
He came to see that in someone like P.T. Barnum, in the men who brought cows and horses and set up a rodeo in what is now Harlem, in A.T. Stewart, who was the great merchant of the time, these examples of people who could get an idea, piece things together and present it to the world for profit or loss and take great big risks.
Now, we should mention that Lipton's family had a small grocery shop back in Glasgow. When Tommy Lipton was in the U.S., what was he learning about the way Americans ran businesses?
He learned that it was far better to scrub up your little store and light it brightly and display your goods with some flair than to try to hide the flaws in your merchandise and pass it off as first-rate goods. And oddly enough, that was the style of retailing in Glasgow at the time when he started out for America. Most of the shops where people bought food had a dismal variety. Mm. You know, you'd go in and there'd be a shipment of 3 dozen eggs for that morning, and when the eggs were gone, the eggs were gone. And if you went to a disreputable grocer, he would give you something left over from the day before that might be spoiled, and you wouldn't discover it until you got home. And in America, he found these places where the offerings were varied, but also well-lit. People actually enjoyed shopping. It wasn't considered a terrible chore, and you didn't have to fight with the merchant over the price and the quality of the goods.
After 5 years in the U.S., Lipton returns to Glasgow, to his home, in 1870. A year later, he opens the first branch of Lipton's Market, and it becomes a huge success, like almost overnight. What made it different?
Well, for one thing, Lipton had fun. This was a guy who put concave and convex mirrors outside the store so you could look at yourself as a fat man and a skinny man. In the morning, you might follow a parade of pigs that he had arranged.
You wrote that sometimes he hired a dozen overweight men and then a dozen very, very thin men on opposite sides of the streets. They would march down holding placards, one side saying, going to Lipton's, the other side. They were holding signs saying, coming from Lipton's.
Oh, absolutely. It was a good thing to be kind of rotund back then. It meant you were a person of wealth and you were well-fed. And so it was a combination of the quality of the goods and the lighting. Now, this is a funny thing to think about. It gets dark very early in the day in the winters in Glasgow.
And anybody who's been there knows that at 2 o'clock, it's dusk.
And he was a fellow who decided to spend money on gas. So he had many, many light fixtures installed in his store. You could turn the corner and look down the street, and the only thing you might really notice is Lipton's shop.
Wow. Of course, he expands. He becomes a fairly wealthy man. That's when he decides to get into tea. You write that sort of around the 1880s, the average Briton was drinking 35 gallons of tea a year. Why did he decide to get into tea if he was already successful in the food business?
In the 1870s and 1880s, tea was a very unreliable product. You could go into a market and have your tea measured out and get home and discover that half of it is spoiled. Mm. It would have a terrible taste. They actually recycled tea. There were scavengers who would go by cafes and restaurants and hotels in the afternoons and collect the used tea from the morning.
And then resell it.
and then resell it.
Right.
They might mix it with some fresh leaves. Lipton saw here also that there was a monopoly in a place called Mincing Lane. Wonderful name. Mm. Mincing Lane was really the middleman for all the tea sold in Great Britain. He decided that he could match Mincing Lane and he could beat them. And he did. He really developed the first consistent brand of tea that was the same from package to package, from location to location, every time you bought it. And he priced it at half the price of other manufacturers. And so it was a runaway hit.
The other side of your book, it has an entirely separate side, which is really about Lipton's celebrity. He was sort of, a kind of a Richard Branson meets Larry Ellison of the early 20th century. After he becomes famous, rich, successful, he's knighted and so on, he decides to enter probably the most prestigious sailing competition, the America's Cup. For the first time in 1899, he does it 5 more times. First of all, why did he decide to do this?
This is something that today escapes most of us. But in 1899, it wasn't the World Series that people followed. People waited for these great yachting competitions because they were not only sporting events, but they were contests of technology. It was literally America and America's science, America's engineering, America's industry versus Great Britain.
He competed, what, about five times between 1899 and 1930?
Five times. Each time he lost, each time he won more love and more affection from the American public. And I think it was because he represented every immigrant who ever came to America, every poor boy who ever wanted to make it. He came from tougher beginnings than we can even imagine today. He grew up in a slum that Friedrich Engels called the worst industrial neighborhood in the world. Uneducated, he came to America, learned how to become someone else, went back to Great Britain and did it, and had such style, had such grace and humor that the Americans loved him. So he was the guy standing up for every Irishman and every Scot and eventually every Italian and every Jew who ever came and tried to make it in a tough place. So every time he lost, he actually won.
That's Michael D'Antonio, author of A Full Cup, Sir Thomas Lipton's Extraordinary Life and His Quest for the America's Cup. Michael, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
This next story is for those of us who find ourselves answering emails on our BlackBerry, even as we chatter away on our iPhones. Those of us who find our right index fingers twitching on the mouse, even as we type, just itching to click on something new every few seconds. It's for those of us, in other words, who without even realizing it, have signed up for a life where we're basically all connected all the time. Now, whether this is a good thing is the subject of William Powers' new book. It's called Hamlet's Blackberry. And William Powers, early in the book, you describe a scene that rang so true to me. You were standing at a crosswalk in Manhattan. Tell me what happened.
I was standing at a crosswalk, and I looked around me, and there were 5 to 8 people, maybe as many as 10 people, everyone staring into a digital device, basically staring into their palm. And here I was in New York, the most fantastic city in the world, so much to look at, to see and hear, and everybody around me essentially wasn't present.
In this very busy city, but all
yes.
in their own little worlds.
You know, and these gadgets are wonderful and they do fantastic stuff for us all day long, but to miss out on your surroundings all the time, which I think we increasingly do, I really question that.
That's a scene that many of us who live in big cities or travel to big cities can relate to these days. What struck me in your book was that this is actually not a totally new phenomenon, this feeling of being overwhelmed with technology and communication. You don't think, for example, about ancient Rome, Seneca, wandering around being overwhelmed by all the communication demands. In your book, you write, maybe he was.
It's true. You know, in trying to solve this problem, which I call the conundrum of connectedness, this idea that we have these devices, we love them, they do so much for us, and yet they also impose this burden on us and are beginning to pull us away from stuff that really matters. In trying to solve it, I looked to the past to see if there were other times when people faced a similar challenge that we could learn from. And I found there really were. There were quite a number of times whenever a new technology comes along that fills everyday life with new information, people feel a bit overwhelmed and can even become addicted to it. And indeed, the Roman philosopher Seneca felt so burdened by the connectedness of his own time and the crazy kind of pace of life in ancient Rome, he talked about he and his friends suffering from, quote, the restless energy of a hunted mind, the inability to get away from their connected lives, much as we can't seem to get away from our screens.
And in his case, what was it that was so overwhelming?
Well, it was empire. It was the idea of empire, which had pulled everyone together very tightly, and people were living in these cities that were bigger than cities anyone had ever lived in before. There was noise, and there was just busyness. There was more work. There was paperwork. It was papyrus work at the time, but it was paperwork. There was bureaucracy. There was just a lot of incoming. Now, living in the electronic age, we think, God, that incoming must have been so slow and manageable. But to them, as today, it was a new thing. It was a major step up in basically the hecticness of everyday life, and they had trouble managing it.
Flash forward a few centuries, and you have another example I loved. This is Shakespeare's time.
Mm-hmm.
When the printing press was suddenly flooding people with all of this printed material that they hadn't obviously had access to before. And you write about how in his great work, Hamlet, Shakespeare actually gives Hamlet a device to deal with this. Tell us about that.
Yes, there's a point in the play, early in the play, where Hamlet meets the ghost, and the ghost has this terrible news about Hamlet's father having been murdered. And Hamlet is so overwhelmed by this news, this new piece of information, that he's not sure what to do with it. And he talks about how cluttered and distracted his mind is, actually, much like our minds today. And he reaches into his pocket, or the clothing he wears, and he pulls out something he refers to as his tables. And this moment tends to go by in the play when we're watching it, because we think of a table like the table we eat breakfast on. But in fact, tables in that time were a new gadget that people used to sort of bring order to their everyday lives. And it was basically an erasable, plaster-like surface inside of a little booklet. You could write notes during the day and then wipe them away clean at night, so that in a sense, the burden of the printed word, which is what the information overload at that time was, could be wiped away. And this new gadget, interestingly, was a way of dealing with overload.
Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. Because the flip side here is we all love all this technology. I mean, I love my iPhone. You could not pry it from my cold, dead hands. So what are we to do?
We do. In fact, early in the book, I have a chapter called The Magic of Screens, in which I talk about how amazingly magical they are and the great things they do. I mean, with a few keystrokes, I can bring up an old manuscript from the British Museum. You know, that is miraculous. The trouble is, when so much information is coming at us all day long, we don't have any gaps, any breaks in which to make sense of it, do something new, creative with it, enjoy it, really. And the same with our relationships. If we're constantly toggling between people on Facebook and texts and all these new ways of connecting all day long, and we never have a sustained connection, it's not really connectedness. So my aim in the book is to help people develop new strategies where we're just smarter about this, where we connect more wisely and get more out of it.
I guess the obvious solution is we should just unplug, turn off all these devices. I have a friend, actually, who's trying to write a book, and he's just paid $10 for a software program to block his internet access so he can actually get some writing done. I mean, is this what it's come to?
It has come to that. There are all kinds of emerging answers like that, and they are very much in sync with my message. I think we've only just begun to recognize that connectedness serves us best when it's balanced by a little bit of disconnectedness. And it's all about that. It's basically about having some of A and then some of B, and they actually offset and enrich each other. My family has a ritual where we disconnect on the weekends. We call it the Internet Sabbath.
Disconnect, turn off what?
We turn
all
off
modems,
the household modem.
Okay.
And we don't have smartphones, so therefore we can't get out our inboxes for the whole weekend. We can't do web surfing. We can still call. And it's wonderful. And interestingly, the effects of it, both on our family life, our work lives, everything, carry over into the week. Even when we're connected, we can feel the benefits of having been disconnected a couple days ago. It really helps. It's just about that simple word, balance. But as a lot of people can attest, it's very hard to pull away. You have to know why you're doing it and really believe.
Well, William Powers, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
That's William Powers. His new book is Hamlet's Blackberry. And you can read an excerpt from William Powers' new book on our website at npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. National Book Award finalist Allegra Goodman has often been celebrated by reviewers as a contemporary counterpart to Jane Austen. In novels like Intuition, Paradise Park, and Catterskill Falls, that comparison has been made because of Goodman's astute attention to manners and characters. But now in her new novel, The Cookbook Collector, Goodman makes her debt to Austen explicit by transporting Sense and Sensibility to the Silicon Valley of the 1990s. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says there's more going on here than mere imitation.
There's a luscious party scene about two-thirds of the way through The Cookbook Collector, in which a group of youngish, very clever people gather in an exquisite mansion in Northern California. Champagne and strawberries are served, and the afternoon light turns golden as the day wanes. That scene, for me, captures the overall mood and appeal of Allegra Goodman's new novel. It's shimmering and astute and a little melancholy. In short, it's a midsummer's dream of a novel. There's even a nearby enchanted forest thrown in this case filled with giant California redwoods rather than Arden's ferns and fairies. The Cookbook Collector is about all kinds of appetites for love and sex and God and money and, of course, food. The story revolves around two sisters, Jess, a beautiful 23-year-old graduate student in philosophy, hops impulsively from passion to passion. In contrast, we're told that Jess's older sister, Emily, is possessed of a serene rationality. At only 28, Emily is the multimillionaire CEO of a dot-com startup. If that flighty sister versus level-headed sister premise sounds familiar, it should. Goodman herself has called her latest novel A Sense and Sensibility for the Digital Age. I confess, if anyone other than Allegra Goodman had made that claim, I very likely would have tossed my review copy away. I am very weary of the literary fad of contemporary authors shoplifting plots and characters from the 19th century fiction warehouse. Poor Jane Austen, in particular, has been plucked clean. If you don't know what I'm talking about, check out your local bookstore where you'll find the latest violations, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, and Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters. Is there no shame? But Goodman, as she always does, makes a believer out of this skeptic. Goodman says of one of her characters, a brilliant computer programmer, that he had an acquisitive intelligence, and when he appropriated an idea, he improved it until his own version obliterated its source. Of course, I wouldn't go that insanely far in praising Goodman's update of Austen, but I will say that this homage quickly comes to have a glorious life of its own. Jess, the faint reincarnation of impulsive Marianne Dashwood, bicycles around the Berkeley of the 1990s when the novel is set, flitting from philosophy to veganism to tree saving. When Jess begins working part-time at a used and rare bookstore called Yorick's, run by a wealthy, single, middle-aged man called George, we Austen-savvy readers anticipate that wedding bells may eventually ring. But not before fresh complications ensue, especially since Jess is already involved with a charismatic, radical environmentalist. Here's George musing resentfully at the sight of Jess and her hipster boyfriend. Why was it, George asked himself, that the youngest, most innocent-looking women consorted with the creepiest men? Their boyfriends were not boys or friends at all, but shadowy familiars, bears, wolfhounds, panthers. George himself has buried his own animal appetites in books, although Jess's entry into his life and the incursion of the internet into the book trade is making George rethink his monastic ways and the all-too-rare pleasures of reuniting a customer with a long-sought-after copy of, say, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Goodman's nimble language, usually displayed in her characters' sharp readings of one another, is one of the great pleasures of her writing. The other is her ability to integrate serious metaphysical questions into her entertaining comedies of manners. The way in which The Cookbook Collector ultimately veers off from a mere riff on Sense and Sensibility raises crucial doubts about the value of a well-ordered life, as well as the existence of a benevolent God. In Austen's original, Eleanor, the practical one, was rewarded for having 2 feet on the ground. That was the late Enlightenment talking through Austen. But here, in Goodman, modernity pulls the rug out from under Emily's feet.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Cookbook Collector by Allegra Goodman. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.